canopy, on top of the high mast, he could see the lonely figure of the skater. He took another drink. He cupped his hand and called huskily, "Hey!" There was no answer. "Hey!" he called louder and looked around to see if the cops had come out of their place beside the bank. Down from the sky came a surly reply, "What do you want?" Richard cupped his hands again.
How do you go to the toilet?"
"I've got a can up here," said the voice. Richard turned and walked back the way he had come. He walked along Lighthouse and up through the pines, and he came to his house and let himself in. As he undressed, he knew his wife was awake. She bubbled a little when she was asleep. He got into bed, and she made room for him. "He's got a can up there," Richard said.
Chapter 20. In mid-morning, the Model T truck rolled triumphantly home to Cannery Row and hopped the gutter and creaked up through the weeds to its place behind Lee Chong's. The boys blocked up the front wheels, drained what gasoline was left into a 5-gallon can, took their frogs, and went wearily home to the Palace Flophouse. Then Mac made a ceremonious visit to Lee Chong while the boys got a fire going in the big stove. Mac thanked Lee with dignity for lending the truck. He spoke of the great success of the trip, of the hundreds of frogs taken. Lee smiled shyly and waited for the inevitable. "We're in the chips," Mac said enthusiastically. "Doc pays us a nickel a frog, and we got about 1,000. Lee nodded. The price was standard. Everybody knew that. "Doc's away," said Mac. "Jesus, is he gonna be happy when he sees all them frogs?" Lee nodded again. He knew Doc was away, and he also knew where the conversation was going. "Say, by the way," said Mac, as though he had just thought of it, "we're a little bit short right now." He managed to make it sound like a very unusual situation.
"No whiskey," said Lee Chong, and he smiled. Mac was outraged. "What would we want whiskey for? Why, we got a gallon of the finest whiskey you ever laid a lip over. A whole full goddamn running over gallon. By the way," he continued, "I and the boys would like to have you just step up for a snort with us. They told me to ask you." In spite of himself, Lee smiled with pleasure. They wouldn't offer it if they didn't have it.
"No," said Mac, "I'll lay it on the line. I and the boys are pretty short and we're pretty hungry. You know the price of frogs is 20 for a buck. Now, Doc is away and we're hungry. So what we thought is this. We don't want to see you lose nothing, so we'll make over to you 25 frogs for a buck. You got a 5-frog profit there, and nobody loses his shirt."
"No," said Lee. "No money."
"Well, hell, Lee, all we need is a little groceries. I'll tell you what, we want to give Doc a little party when he gets back. We got plenty of liquor, but we'd like to get maybe some steaks and stuff like that. He's such a nice guy. Hell, when your wife had that bad tooth, who gave her the laudanum?"
Mac had him. Lee was indebted to Doc, deeply indebted. What Lee was having trouble comprehending was how his indebtedness to Doc made it necessary that he give credit to Mac.
"We didn't want you to have, like, a mortgage on frogs," Mac went on. "We will actually deliver right into your hands 25 frogs for every buck of groceries you let us have. And you can come to the party, too."
Lee's mind nosed over the proposition like a mouse in a cheese cupboard. He could find nothing wrong with it. The whole thing was legitimate. Frogs were cash as far as Doc was concerned. The price was standard, and Lee had a double profit. He had his 5-frog margin, and also he had the grocery markup. The whole thing hinged on whether they actually had any frogs.
"We go see frog," Lee said at last.
In front of the palace, he had a drink of the whiskey, inspected the damp sacks of frogs, and agreed to the transaction. He stipulated, however, that he would take no dead frogs. Now Mac counted 50 frogs into a can and walked back to the grocery with Lee and got $2 worth of bacon and eggs and bread. Lee, anticipating a brisk business, brought a big packing case out and put it into the vegetable department. He emptied the 50 frogs into it and covered it with the wet gunny sack to keep his charges happy. And business was brisk. Eddie sauntered down and bought 2 frogs worth of Bull Durham. Jones was outraged a little later when the price of Coca-Cola went up from 1 to 2 frogs. In fact, bitterness arose as the day wore on and prices went up. Steak, for instance, the very best steak, shouldn't have been more than 10 frogs a pound, but Lee set it at 12.5. Canned peaches were sky-high, 8 frogs for a No. 2 can. Lee had a stranglehold on the consumers. He was pretty sure that the thrift market or Holman's would not approve of this new monetary system. If the boys wanted steak, they knew they had to pay Lee's prices. Feeling ran high when Hazel, who had coveted a pair of yellow silk armbands for a long time, was told that if he didn't want to pay 35 frogs for them, he could go somewhere else. The poison of greed was already creeping into the innocent and laudable merchandising agreement. Bitterness was piling up. But in Lee's packing case, the frogs were piling up, too. Financial bitterness could not eat too deeply into Mac and the boys, for they were not mercantile men. They did not measure their joy in goods sold, their egos in bank balances, nor their loves in what they cost. While they were mildly irritated that Lee was taking them for an economic ride, or perhaps hop, $2 worth of bacon and eggs was in their stomachs, lying right on top of a fine slug of whiskey, and right on top of the breakfast was another slug of whiskey. And they sat in their own chairs in their own house and watched Darling learning to drink canned milk out of a sardine can. Darling was, and was destined to remain, a very happy dog, for in the group of 5 men there were 5 distinct theories of dog training, theories which clashed so that Darling never got any training at all. From the first, she was a precocious bitch. She slept on the bed of the man who had given her the last bribe. They really stole for her sometimes. They wooed her away from one another. Occasionally, all 5 agreed that things had to change and that Darling must be disciplined. But in the discussion of method, the intention invariably drifted away. They were in love with her. They found the little puddles she left on the floor charming. They bored all their acquaintances with her cuteness, and they would have killed her with food if in the end she hadn't had better sense than they. Jones made her a bed in the bottom of the grandfather clock, but Darling never used it. She slept with one or another of them as the fancy moved her. She chewed the blankets, tore the mattresses, sprayed the feathers out of the pillows. She coquetted and played her owners against one another. They thought she was wonderful. Mac intended to teach her tricks and go in vaudeville, and he didn't even housebreak her. They sat in the afternoon, smoking, digesting, considering, and now and then having a delicate drink from the jug. And each time they warned that they must not take too much, for it was to be for Doc. They must not forget that for a minute. "What time you figure he'll be back?" Eddie asked. "Usually gets in about 8 or 9 o'clock," said Mac.
Now we got to figure when we're going to give it. I think we ought to give it tonight.
Sure, the others agreed.
Maybe he might be tired, Hazel suggested. That's a long drive.
Hell, said Jones. Nothing rests you like a good party. I've been so dog-tired my pants were dragging, and then I went to a party and felt fine.
We got to do some real thinking, said Mac. Where are we going to give it? Here?
Well, Doc, he likes his music. He's always got his phonograph going at a party. Maybe he'd be more happy if we give it over at his place.
You got something there, said Mac. But I figure it ought to be like a surprise party. And how are we going to make like it's a party and not just us bringing over a jug of whiskey?
How about decorations? Huey suggested. Like 4th of July or Halloween.
Mac's eyes looked off into space, and his lips were parted. He could see it all.
Huey, he said, I think you got something there. I never would have thought you could do it, but by God, you really rang a duck that time.
His voice grew mellow, and his eyes looked into the future. I can just see it, he said. Doc comes home. He's tired. He drives up. The place is all lit up. He thinks somebody's broke in. He goes up the stairs, and by God, the place has got the hell decorated out of it. There's crepe paper, and there's favors, and a big cake. Jesus, he'd know it was a party then, and wouldn't be no little mouse fart party neither. And we're kind of hiding, so for a minute he don't know who done it. And then we come out yelling. Can't you see his face? By God, Huey, I don't know how you thought of it.
Huey blushed. His conception had been much more conservative, based, in fact, on the New Year's party at La Ida. But if it was going to be like that, why, Huey was willing to take credit.
I just thought it would be nice, he said.
Well, it's a pretty nice thing, said Mac, and I don't mind saying when the surprise kind of wears off, I'm going to tell Doc who thought it up.
They leaned back and considered the thing, and in their minds, the decorated laboratory looked like the conservatory at the Hotel Del Monte. They had a couple more drinks, just to savor the plan.
Lee Chong kept a very remarkable store. For instance, most stores buy yellow and black crepe paper and black paper cats, masks, and papier-mâché pumpkins in October. There's a brisk business for Halloween, and then these items disappear. Maybe they're sold or thrown out, but you can't buy them, say, in June. The same is true of 4th of July equipment, flags and bunting and skyrockets. Where are they in January? Gone. No one knows where. This was not Lee Chong's way. You could buy valentines in November at Lee Chong's, shamrocks, hatchets, and paper cherry trees in August. He had firecrackers he had laid up in 1920. One of the mysteries was where he kept his stock, since his was not a very large store. He had bathing suits he had bought when long skirts and black stockings and head bandanas were in style. He had bicycle clips and tatting shuttles and mahjong sets. He had badges that said, Remember the Maine, and felt pennants commemorating Fighting Bob. He had mementos of the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. Little towers of jewels. And there was one other unorthodoxy in Lee's way of doing business. He never had a sale, never reduced a price, and never remaindered. An article that cost 30 cents in 1912 still was 30 cents, although mice and moths might seem to some to have reduced its value. But there was no question about it. If you wanted to decorate a laboratory in a general way, not being specific about the season, but giving the impression of a cross between Saturnalia and a pageant of the flags of all nations, Lee Chong's was the place to go for your stuff. Mac and the boys knew that, but Mac said, "Where are we going to get a big cake? Lee hasn't got nothing but them little bakery cakes." Huey had been so successful before, he tried again. "Why'n't Eddie bake a cake?" he suggested. "Eddie used to be fry cook at the San Carlos for a while." The instant enthusiasm for the idea drove from Eddie's brain the admission that he had never baked a cake. Mac put it on a sentimental basis besides. "It would mean more to Doc," he said. "It wouldn't be like no goddamned old soggy bought cake. It would have some heart in it." As the afternoon and the whiskey went down, the enthusiasm rose. There were endless trips to Lee Chong's. The frogs were gone from one sack, and Lee's packing case was getting crowded. By 6 o'clock, they had finished the gallon of whiskey and were buying half pints of old tennis shoes at 15 frogs a crack. But the pile of decorating materials was heaped on the floor of the palace flophouse, miles of crepe paper commemorating every holiday in vogue, and some that had been abandoned. Eddie watched his stove like a mother hen. He was baking a cake in the wash basin. The recipe was guaranteed not to fail by the company which made the shortening, but from the first the cake had acted strangely. When the batter was completed, it writhed and panted as though animals were squirming and crawling inside it. Once in the oven, it put up a bubble like a baseball, which grew tight and shiny, and then collapsed with a hissing sound. This left such a crater that Eddie made a new batch of batter and filled in the hole. And now the cake was behaving very curiously, for while the bottom was burning and sending out a black smoke, the top was rising and falling gluey with a series of little explosions. When Eddie finally put it out to cool, it looked like one of Belgetti's miniatures of a battlefield on a lava bed. This cake was not fortunate, for while the boys were decorating the laboratory, Darling ate what she could of it, was sick in it, and finally curled up in its still warm dough and went to sleep. But Mac and the boys had taken the crepe paper, the masks, the broomsticks and paper pumpkins, the red, white, and blue bunting, and moved over the lot and across the street to the laboratory. They disposed of the last of the frogs for a quart of old tennis shoes and 2 gallons of 49-cent wine. "Doc is very fond of wine," said Mac. "I think he likes it even better than whiskey." Doc never locked the laboratory. He went on the theory that anyone who really wanted to break in could easily do it, that people were essentially honest, and that finally there wasn't much the average person would want to steal there anyway. The valuable things were books and records, surgical instruments and optical glass and such things that a practical working burglar wouldn't look at twice. His theory had been sound as far as burglars, snatch thieves, and kleptomaniacs were concerned, but it had been completely ineffective regarding his friends. Books were often borrowed. No can of beans ever survived his absence, and on several occasions, returning late, he had found guests in his bed. The boys piled the decorations in the anteroom, and then Mac stopped them. "What's going to make Doc happiest?" he asked. "The party," said Hazel. "No," said Mac. "The decorations?" Huey suggested. He felt responsible for the decorations. "No," said Mac, "the frogs. That's going to make him feel best of all, and maybe by the time he gets here, Lee Chong might be closed, and he can't even see his frogs until tomorrow. No, sir, Mac cried. Them frogs ought to be right here, right in the middle of the room with a piece of bunting on it and a sign that says, Welcome Home, Doc.
The committee which visited Lee met with stern opposition. All sorts of possibilities suggested themselves to his suspicious brain. It was explained that he was going to be at the party so he could watch his property, that no one questioned that they were his. Mac wrote out a paper transferring the frogs to Lee, in case there should be any question. When his protests weakened a little, they carried the packing case over to the laboratory, tacked red, white, and blue bunting over it, lettered the big sign with iodine on a card, and they started the decorating from there. They had finished the whiskey by now, and they really felt in a party mood. They crisscrossed the crepe paper and put the pumpkins up. Passers-by in the street joined the party and rushed over to Lee's to get more to drink. Lee Chong joined the party for a while, but his stomach was notoriously weak, and he got sick and had to go home. At 11 o'clock they fried the steaks and ate them. Someone digging through the records found an album of Count Basie, and the great phonograph roared out. The noise could be heard from the boat works to La Ida. A group of customers from the Bear Flag mistook Western Biological for a rival house and charged up the stairs, whooping with joy. They were evicted by the outraged hosts, but only after a long, happy, and bloody battle that took out the front door and broke two windows. The crashing of jars was unpleasant. Hazel, going through the kitchen to the toilet, tipped the frying pan of hot grease on himself and the floor and was badly burned. At 1:30, a drunk wandered in and passed a remark which was considered insulting to Doc. Mac hit him a clip which is still remembered and discussed. The man rose off his feet, described a small arc, and crashed through the packing case in among the frogs. Someone trying to change a record dropped the tone arm down and broke the crystal. No one has studied the psychology of a dying party. It may be raging, howling, boiling, and then a fever sets in, and a little silence, and then quickly, quickly it is gone. The guests go home, or go to sleep, or wander away to some other affair, and they leave a dead body. The lights blazed in the laboratory. The front door hung sideways by one hinge. The floor was littered with broken glass. Phonograph records, some broken, some only nicked, were strewn about. The plates with pieces of steak ends and coagulating grease were on the floor, on top of the bookcases, under the bed. Whiskey glasses lay sadly on their sides. Someone trying to climb the bookcases had pulled out a whole section of books and spilled them in broken-backed confusion on the floor. And it was empty. It was over. Through the broken end of the packing case, a frog hopped and sat feeling the air for danger. And then another joined him. They could smell the fine, damp, cool air coming in the door and in through the broken windows. One of them sat on the fallen card, which said, Welcome Home, Doc. And then the two hopped timidly toward the door. For quite a while, a little river of frogs hopped down the steps, a swirling, moving river. For quite a while, Cannery Row crawled with frogs, was overrun with frogs. A taxi, which brought a very late customer to the Bear Flag, squashed five frogs in the street. But well before dawn, they had all gone. Some found the sewer, and some worked their way up the hill to the reservoir, and some went into culverts, and some only hid among the weeds in the vacant lot. And the lights blazed in the quiet, empty laboratory. Chapter 21. In the back room of the laboratory, the white rats in their cages ran and skittered and squeaked.
In the corner of a separate cage, a mother rat lay over her litter of blind, naked children and let them suckle, and the mother stared about nervously and fiercely. In the rattlesnake cage, the snakes lay with their chins resting on their own coils, and they stared straight ahead out of their scowling, dusty black eyes. In another cage, a Gila monster with a skin like a beaded bag reared slowly up and clawed heavily and sluggishly at the wire. The anemones in the aquaria blossomed open with green and purple tentacles and pale green stomachs. The little seawater pump whirred softly, and the needles of driven water hissed into the tanks, forcing lines of bubbles under the surface. It was the hour of the pearl. Lee Chong brought his garbage cans out to the curb. The bouncer stood on the porch of the Bear Flag and scratched his stomach. Sam Malloy crawled out of the boiler and sat on his wood block and looked at the lightning east. Over on the rocks near Hopkins Marine Station, the sea lions barked monotonously. The old Chinaman came up out of the sea with his dripping basket and flip-flapped up the hill. Then a car turned into Cannery Row, and Doc drove up to the front of the laboratory. His eyes were red-rimmed with fatigue. He moved slowly, with tiredness. When the car had stopped, he sat still for a moment to let the road jumps get out of his nerves. Then he climbed out of the car. At his step on the stairs, the rattlesnakes ran out their tongues and listened with their waving forked tongues. The rats scampered madly about the cages. Doc climbed the stairs. He looked in wonder at the sagging door and at the broken window. The weariness seemed to go out of him. He stepped quickly inside. Then he went quickly from room to room, stepping around the broken glass. He bent down quickly and picked up a smashed phonograph record and looked at its title. In the kitchen, the spilled grease had turned white on the floor. Doc's eyes flamed red with anger. He sat down on his couch, and his head settled between his shoulders, and his body weaved a little in his rage. Suddenly, he jumped up and turned on the power in his great phonograph. He put on a record and put down the arm. Only a hissing roar came from the loudspeaker. He lifted the arm, stopped the turntable, and sat down on the couch again. On the stairs, there were bumbling, uncertain footsteps, and through the door came Mac. His face was red. He stood uncertainly in the middle of the room. "Doc," he said, "I and the boys..." For the moment, Doc hadn't seemed to see him. Now he leaped to his feet. Mac shuffled backward. "Did you do this?" "Well, I and the boys..." Doc's small, hard fist whipped out and splashed against Mac's mouth. Doc's eyes shone with a red animal rage. Mac sat down heavily on the floor. Doc's fist was hard and sharp. Mac's lips were split against his teeth, and one front tooth bent sharply inward. "Get up," said Doc. Mac lumbered to his feet. His hands were at his sides. Doc hit him again, a cold, calculated, punishing punch in the mouth. The blood spurted from Mac's lips and ran down his chin. He tried to lick his lips. "Put up your hands! Fight, you son of a bitch!" Doc cried, and he hit him again and heard the crunch of breaking teeth. Mac's head jolted, but he was braced now so he wouldn't fall, and his hands stayed at his sides. "Go ahead, Doc," he said thickly through his broken lips. "I got it coming." Doc's shoulders sagged with defeat. "You son of a bitch," he said bitterly.
Oh, you dirty son of a bitch!
He sat down on the couch and looked at his cut knuckles. Mac sat down in a chair and looked at him. Mac's eyes were wide and full of pain. He didn't even wipe away the blood that flowed down his chin. In Doc's head, the monotonal opening of Monteverdi's Jorcalchel e la Terra began to form, the infinitely sad and resigned mourning of Petrarch for Laura. Doc saw Mac's broken mouth through the music that was in his head and in the air. Mac sat perfectly still, almost as though he could hear the music too. Doc glanced at the place where the Monteverdi album was, and then he remembered that the phonograph was broken. He got to his feet. "Go wash your face," he said, and he went out and down the stairs and across the street to Lee Chong's. Lee wouldn't look at him as he got 2 quarts of beer out of the icebox. He took the money without saying anything. Doc walked back across the street. Mac was in the toilet cleaning his bloody face with wet paper towels. Doc opened a bottle and poured gently into a glass, holding it at an angle so that very little collar rose to the top. He filled a second tall glass and carried the 2 into the front room. Mac came back dabbing at his mouth with wet toweling. Doc indicated the beer with his head. Now Mac opened his throat and poured down half the glass without swallowing. He sighed explosively and stared into the beer. Doc had already finished his glass. He brought the bottle in and filled both glasses again. He sat down on his couch.
"What happened?" he asked.
Mac looked at the floor, and a drop of blood fell from his lips into his beer. He mopped his split lips again.
"I and the boys wanted to give you a party. We thought you'd be home last night."
Doc nodded his head.
"I see." "She got out of hand," said Mac. "It don't do no good to say I'm sorry. I've been sorry all my life. This ain't no new thing. It's always like this."
He swallowed deeply from his glass.
"I had a wife," Mac said. "Same thing. Everything I'd done turned sour. She couldn't stand it anymore. If I'd done a good thing, it got poisoned up some way. If I'd give her a present, there was something wrong with it. She only got hurt from me. She couldn't stand it no more. Same thing every place till I just got to clowning. I don't do nothing but clown no more. Try to make the boys laugh."
Doc nodded again. The music was sounding in his head again, complaint and resignation all in one.
"I know," he said. "I was glad when you hit me," Mac went on. "I thought to myself, maybe this'll teach me. Maybe I'll remember this. But hell, I won't remember nothing. I won't learn nothing. Doc," Mac cried, "the way I seen it, we was all happy and having a good time. You was glad because we was giving you a party, and we was glad. The way I seen it, it was a good party."
He waved his hand at the wreckage on the floor.
"Same thing when I was married. I'd think her out, and then... But it never come off that way."
"I know," said Doc. He opened the second quart of beer and poured the glasses full.
"Doc," said Mac, "I and the boys will clean up here, and we'll pay for the stuff that's broke. If it takes us 5 years, we'll pay for it."
Doc shook his head slowly and wiped the beer foam from his mustache.
"No," he said. "I'll clean it up. I know where everything goes. We'll pay for it, Doc."
No, you won't, Mac, said Doc. You'll think about it, and it'll worry you for quite a long time, but you won't pay for it. There's maybe $300 in broken museum glass. Don't say you'll pay for it. That'll keep you uneasy. It might be 2 or 3 years before you forget about it and felt entirely easy again, and you wouldn't pay it anyway.
I guess you're right, said Mac. God damn it, I know you're right. What can we do?
I'm over it, said Doc. Those socks in the mouth got it out of my system. Let's forget it.
Mac finished his beer and stood up. So long, Doc, he said.
So long. Say, Mac, what happened to your wife?
I don't know, said Mac. She went away.
He walked clumsily down the stairs and crossed over and walked up the lot and up the chicken walk to the palace flophouse. Doc watched his progress through the window. And then, wearily, he got a broom from behind the water heater. It took him all day to clean up the mess.
Chapter 22. Henri the painter was not French, and his name was not Henri. Also, he was not really a painter. Henri had so steeped himself in stories of the left bank in Paris that he lived there, although he had never been there. Feverishly, he followed in periodicals the Dadaist movements and schisms, the strangely feminine jealousies and religiousness, the obscurantisms of the forming and breaking schools. Regularly, he revolted against outworn techniques and materials. One season he threw out perspective. Another year he abandoned red, even as the mother of purple. Finally he gave up paint entirely. It is not known whether Henri was a good painter or not, for he threw himself so violently into movements that he had very little time left for painting of any kind. About his painting there is some question. You couldn't judge very much from his productions in different colored chicken feathers and nutshells, but as a boat builder, he was superb. Henri was a wonderful craftsman. He had lived in a tent years ago when he started his boat, and until galley and cabin were complete enough to move into. But once he was housed and dry, he had taken his time on the boat. The boat was sculptured rather than built. It was 35 feet long, and its lines were in constant state of flux. For a while, it had a clipper bow and a fantail like a destroyer. Another time, it had looked vaguely like a caravel. Since Henri had no money, it sometimes took him months to find a plank or a piece of iron or a dozen brass screws. That was the way he wanted it, for Henri never wanted to finish his boat. It sat among the pine trees on a lot Henri rented for $5 a year. This paid the taxes and satisfied the owner. The boat rested in a cradle on concrete foundations. A rope ladder hung over the side except when Henri was at home. Then he pulled up the rope ladder and only put it down when guests arrived. His little cabin had a wide, padded seat that ran around three sides of the room. On this he slept, and on this his guests sat. A table folded down when it was needed, and a brass lamp hung from the ceiling. His galley was a marvel of compactness, but every item in it had been the result of months of thought and work. Henri was swarthy and morose. He wore a beret long after other people abandoned them. He smoked a calabash pipe, and his dark hair fell about his face. Henri had many friends whom he loosely classified as those who could feed him and those whom he had to feed. His boat had no name.
Henri said he would name it when it was finished. Henri had been living in and building his boat for 10 years. During that time, he had been married twice and had promoted a number of semi-permanent liaisons. And all of these young women had left him for the same reason. The 7-foot cabin was too small for 2 people. They resented bumping their heads when they stood up, and they definitely felt the need for a toilet. Marine toilets obviously would not work in a shore-bound boat, and Henri refused to compromise with the spurious landsman's toilet. He and his friend of the moment had to stroll away among the pines, and one after another his loves left him. Just after the girl he had called Alice left him, a very curious thing happened to Henri. Each time he was left alone, he mourned formally for a while, but actually he felt a sense of relief. He could stretch out in his little cabin. He could eat what he wanted. He was glad to be free of the endless female biologic functions for a while. It had become his custom, each time he was deserted, to buy a gallon of wine, to stretch out on the comfortably hard bunk, and get drunk. Sometimes he cried a little all by himself, but it was luxurious stuff, and he usually had a wonderful feeling of well-being from it. He would read Rimbaud aloud with a very bad accent, marveling the while at his fluid speech. It was during one of his ritualistic mournings for the lost Alice that the strange thing began to happen. It was night, and his lamp was burning, and he had just barely begun to get drunk, when suddenly he knew he was no longer alone. He let his eye wander cautiously up and across the cabin, and there, on the other side, sat a devilish young man, a dark, handsome young man. His eyes gleamed with cleverness and spirit and energy, and his teeth flashed. There was something very dear and yet terrible in his face, and beside him sat a golden-haired little boy, hardly more than a baby. The man looked down at the baby, and the baby looked back and laughed delightedly as though something wonderful were about to happen. Then the man looked over at Henri and smiled, and he glanced back at the baby. From his upper left vest pocket, he took an old-fashioned straight-edged razor. He opened it and indicated the child with the gesture of his head. He put a hand among the curls, and the baby laughed gleefully, and then the man tilted the chin and cut the baby's throat. And the baby went right on laughing. But Henri was howling with terror. It took him a long time to realize that neither the man nor the baby was still there. Henri, when his shaking had subsided a little, rushed out of his cabin, leaped over the side of the boat, and hurried away down the hill through the pines. He walked for several hours, and at last he walked down to Cannery Row. Doc was in the basement working on cats when Henri burst in. Doc went on working while Henri told about it, and when it was over, Doc looked closely at him to see how much actual fear and how much theater was there. And it was mostly fear. "Is it a ghost, do you think?" Henri demanded. "Is it some reflection of something that has happened, or is it some Freudian horror out of me? Or am I completely nuts? I saw it, I tell you. It happened right in front of me as plainly as I see you."
"I don't know," said Doc.
"Well, will you come up with me and see if it comes back?"
"No," said Doc. "If I saw it, it might be a ghost, and it would scare me badly because I don't believe in ghosts. And if you saw it again and I didn't, it would be a hallucination, and you would be frightened."
"But what am I going to do?" Henri asked.
If I see it again, I'll know what's going to happen, and I'm sure I'll die. You see, he doesn't look like a murderer. He looks nice, and the kid looks nice, and neither of them gives a damn. Then he cut that baby's throat. I saw it.
I don't know, said Doc. I'm not a psychiatrist or a witch hunter, and I'm not going to start now. A girl's voice called into the basement.
Hi, Doc. Can I come in?
Come along, said Doc. She was a rather pretty and very alert girl. Doc introduced her to Henri.
He's got a problem, said Doc. He either has a ghost or a terrible conscience, and he doesn't know which. Tell her about it, Henri.
Henri went over the story again, and the girl's eyes sparkled.
But that's horrible, she said when he finished. I've never in my life even caught the smell of a ghost. Let's go back up and see if he comes again.
Doc watched them go a little sourly. After all, it had been his date. The girl never did see the ghost, but she was fond of Henri, and it was 5 months before the cramped cabin and the lack of a toilet drove her out.
Chapter 23. A black gloom settled over the palace flophouse. All the joy went out of it. Mac came back from the laboratory with his mouth torn and his teeth broken. As a kind of penance, he did not wash his face. He went to his bed and pulled his blanket over his head, and he didn't get up all day. His heart was as bruised as his mouth. He went over all the bad things he had done in his life, and everything he had ever done seemed bad. He was very sad. Huey and Jones sat for a while staring into space, and then morosely they went over to the Hediondo cannery and applied for jobs, and got them. Hazel felt so bad that he walked to Monterey and picked a fight with a soldier and lost it on purpose. That made him feel a little better to be utterly beaten by a man Hazel could have licked without half trying. Darling was the only happy one of the whole club. She spent the day under Mac's bed, happily eating up his shoes. She was a clever dog, and her teeth were very sharp. Twice in his black despair, Mac reached under the bed and caught her and put her in bed with him for company, but she squirmed out and went back to eating his shoes. Eddie mooned on down to La Ida, talked to his friend the bartender. He got a few drinks and borrowed some nickels with which he played Melancholy Baby 5 times on the jukebox. Mac and the boys were under a cloud, and they knew it, and they knew they deserved it. They had become social outcasts. All of their good intentions were forgotten now. The fact that the party was given for Doc, if it was known, was never mentioned or taken into consideration. The story ran through the Bear Flag. It was told in the canneries. At La Ida, drunks disgusted virtuously. Lee Chong refused to comment. He was feeling financially bruised. And the story, as it grew, went this way. They had stolen liquor and money. They had maliciously broken into the laboratory and systematically destroyed it out of pure malice and evil. People who really knew better took this view. Some of the drunks at La Ida considered going over and beating the hell out of the whole lot of them to show them they couldn't do a thing like that to Doc. Only a sense of the solidarity and fighting ability of Mac and the boys saved them from some kind of reprisal. There were people who felt virtuous about the affair who hadn't had the material of virtue for a long time. The fiercest of the whole lot was Tom Shalligan, who would have been at the party if he'd known about it. Socially, Mac and the boys were beyond the pale. Sam Malloy, didn't speak to them as they went by the boiler. They drew into themselves, and no one could foresee how they would come out of the cloud, for there are two possible reactions to social ostracism. Either a man emerges determined to be better, purer, and kindlier, or he goes bad, challenges the world, and does even worse things. This last is by far the commonest reaction to stigma. Mac and the boys balanced on the scales of good and evil. They were kind and sweet to Darling. They were forbearing and patient with one another. When the first reaction was over, they gave the Palace Flophouse a cleaning such as it had never had. They polished the bright work on the stove, and they washed all their clothes and blankets. Financially, they had become dull and solvent. Huey and Jones were working and bringing home their pay. They bought groceries up the hill at the thrift market because they could not stand the reproving eyes of Lee Chong. It was during this time that Doc made an observation which may have been true, but since there was one factor missing in his reasoning, it is not known whether he was correct. It was the 4th of July. Doc was sitting in the laboratory with Richard Frost. They drank beer and listened to a new album of Scarlatti and looked out the window. In front of the Palace Flophouse there was a large log of wood where Mac and the boys were sitting in the mid-morning sun. They faced down the hill toward the laboratory. Doc said, "Look at them. There are your true philosophers.